Hello and welcome to Conversations from the Adoption and Fostering podcast. In this episode, I speak to Kiri, an adoptive parent living in North Carolina in the US. Kiri shares her experience of being a licensed foster carer and adopting from the state system. She shares her perspectives on that system and shines a light on how it differs from the UK. Kiri discusses the challenge that they faced as a family and the impact on her son. And she also shares her experience of developing and maintaining links with her children's birth mother, counter to the norm within the foster to adopt system in the US. Kiri now campaigns to raise awareness of the challenges faced by adoptive families, and you can find details of her work and writing in the podcast notes. As always, if you've experience of adoption, fostering, or special guardianship from any perspective, and would like to share that on the podcast, please get in touch through the Facebook or Twitter page, or you can email us at anfpodcast@gmail.com.
So I'm Kiri Williams, and I live in North Carolina, and I have five children. I have a blended family, so I have birth children, stepchildren, and adopted children. I have two children who are adopted out of foster care with complex mental health issues, and so I do a lot of advocacy around that, in particular, around some of the dysfunctions in the system, the child welfare and mental health systems, and advocating for parents and also for children getting the services they need, and kind of trying to tell the story, because I think that there's not a lot of information out there about what it's actually like and what the needs are. So I try to kind of be really honest and transparent and say, this is what it's like being a family in crisis. This is what we need, so that the people who are in those positions, like therapists, for example, can understand the situation and try to come up with solutions for our families.
Cool. So can you sort of, I mean, obviously you've got a big family, but can you walk us through how adoption came to be for you? You know, did you start as a foster carer? Mm-hmm.
So I was a foster parent actually as a single person in my early 20s before I got married. I always had like a real passion for foster care. And then after I got married, my husband had a son from his previous marriage. So that's my stepson. And then we had a child together. Then we became foster parents together. So we had to, of course, relicense together once we had gotten married. And we did foster parent for a little while. We then attempted to adopt a child out of foster care who had already been TPR'd, which I'm not sure with the UK audience if they're familiar with what a TPR is, but that's a termination of parental rights. So, you know, you can have kids in foster care who are either on the permanency track to be reunited with their families or to go into adoptive homes. And they're not actually available for adoption until they're what's called TPR'd.
Right, yeah.
Or the judge has terminated them. So I actually personally feel that foster to adopt is a bit of a conflict of interest, because the foster parent is supposed to be supporting reuniting the child with their birth parent. Yeah. And I don't know how you can do that if you also want to adopt that child. So I was never open to adopting a child or looking to adopt a child who's in foster care. So when I was a foster parent, I was a foster parent. And then when I was interested in adopting, I was only looking at kids who were TPR'd. So we took in a child who had already been TPR'd. He was around, I believe, 7 or 8 years old, a little boy who was the same age as my stepson. We were told that he had siblings and he had a lot of siblings. And that's why he couldn't be adopted with his siblings, because the group was so large. And shortly after we got him, he exposed himself to some other children in our neighborhood. And I went back and started, you know, asking a lot of questions that I hadn't asked before, and found out he had been molested, and he also had been molesting his siblings. And so it was really a difficult decision, because of course I didn't want to send him back, but I also knew that this was put my own children at risk, because he had a history of molesting other children at this point. And so I started asking for help, like, how do we handle this child in our home? What do we do? And nobody had answers. So we ended up having to send him back into the system, which was really tragic for us. That was all during the pre-adoption period. So we had not actually gone through with the adoption at that point. And so that was very demoralizing. And so we said, we want to be taken off the adoption list. We don't want to do this again. It's too difficult, too painful. So we got taken off the list. And then within the next 6 months or so our license hadn't actually expired, even though we were off the list. I was contacted about two children to see if we would adopt them. And the reason we were contacted is because the children were biracial, and I'm white. My husband was black. And so they said, these kids would fit in your home because you have other biracial children. And that is a priority to put kids where they look like they fit in the home. So they asked if we would consider adopting these children. And that was the children we did end up adopting, which were Devin, who was 3, and Kayla, who was 2 at the time. And they had been in foster care. I was told they had been in foster care basically since birth. And they were in our home within a matter of weeks after they contacted us. And we went, through the pre-adoption period and, adopted them, I believe within 4 months, which is pretty typical. There's like a mandatory 3-month adoption period.
Yeah. So, when you say you're foster carers, does that, you're a registered foster carer and you have to be sort of licensed is the word you used. Sorry. Does that then include a preparation to adopt, or is it just, was there a specific element where you had to be prepared and kind of, assisted in that journey?
You just have to be a licensed foster parent to adopt out of foster care. And so you have to go through the foster parent training, which is, a certain number of weeks. I'm sure it's different in different states. I adopted out of Florida. So it was like, I believe it was a 9 or 10 week class. It was several years ago, so I don't remember exactly, but it was multiple week class. You have to do a home study. You have to background checks, all of that sort of stuff. And then once you have, once you're a licensed foster parent, you're pretty much qualified to adopt out of foster care, kids who are available out of foster care.
Yeah. How do you then view, private adoptions, which is a huge, there's a huge cohort of families in the US that are adopted through the private system. And you're obviously on a very different track. What are your views and thoughts on that system?
Well, I've known, of course, I know families who've done private adoptions, and I think there's cases where that can be, a good thing. I do think that that is, there's a lot more money, I would say, involved in that type of a system, with private adoptions. So it is more about money and who has, enough money to go into that system, because you do have to have a certain amount of money to pay for the adoption. Where when you adopt out of foster care, the state pays for your legal expenses. If your child has special needs, you get Medicaid for them until they're 18. They have a college education when they turn 18. They have various things. Sometimes you get a stipend for them, like a child support check, basically, until they turn 18. So, you get a lot more support, where I think, and a lot of times with private adoptions, people are looking for younger children. So if you wanted to have especially if you wanted to have an infant, especially if you wanted to have a white infant, you would need to do a private adoption. And that's where a lot of times people do foster to adopt. So if a child is taken out of a hospital from their mother, in fact, this happened to my daughter, because my son was in foster care. The law at the time, I don't know if it's the same now, but the law at the time was, if you have a child in foster care and you have another baby, your other baby is immediately taken from you. So my daughter was immediately taken from her mother from the hospital bed, which is just really tragic to me. But she was taken from the bed. So what happens is, a child like that goes into foster care, and people who want to adopt an infant will do foster to adopt at that point, hoping that that child would become available for adoption, which, again, as I said, I personally feel that that's unethical. I don't like that practice myself, but I know a lot of people do that.
It does feel like it's interesting having the parallel systems in the US. And to a UK listener, we could stop at this point and there's 100 questions, but I'm going to ask you to kind of start to then to continue your story. So you're a licensed foster carer. You've got 2 children who you were asked to foster to adopt these 2 children, these 2 little, a boy and a girl. So, from a, we in the UK, we have, the need for support is just something that is just, it's huge, especially for children who've experienced early adversity. What is the US system? Is it set up? Is there a statutory requirement or a statutory offer? Or are you kind of left to your own devices?
So what happens is when a child is adopted out of foster care, they determine if they're what's called special needs or not. And that can be a special need based on a health need or a mental health need. My children actually were considered special needs because they're biracial, which means they're difficult to get adopted. So that was the basis for them being special needs. And so if your child is deemed special needs, it means that they will get Medicaid until they turn 18. So they have health care. And that's actually, at the time that they told me that, I actually almost said, no, I don't need Medicaid, because I had private health insurance through my job. So I was like, oh, I'm not going to need that. But, you know, I'm actually was very thankful for that, because my children ended up needing a lot of care and there's no copay with Medicaid. So I would have ended up paying thousands and thousands of dollars just in copays alone in my private insurance, and also private insurance. And we might get to this when we talk about the different care my kids had. Private insurance has different limitations. Like, you know, you might get 30 days in a mental health facility, or Medicaid, you know, you can get a year. So, you know, you do get more care. But anyway, so you have to be deemed a special needs child to have that. And also you can get a stipend, and that varies based on state to state. But to give you an idea, when I had got my children, it was $195 a month. So it's not really enough to support a child, but it is like a small amount. That's a child support payment that you get until they turn 18. And then also in the United States, you get any child who's been in the foster care system at all, whether they're adopted or not, they get a free college education through the state schools. And that's because they found that these children, when they age out of foster care or adoptive homes, they tend to not get college educations. So that's why they get that. So I think that's a really huge benefit, actually, for these kids. It's helpful for them.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of money. But I think, you know, I know that in the UK, in theory, that is available for some children, but not those children who are adopted. So that is something that's in place for children who've been adopted out of care in the US.
Yes, if they've spent any time at all in foster care in their life, they can go to a state. It's only a state colleges, but
right.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
There's so many things
for 4 year of this tuition.
I feel like there's so much I need to learn about America before the US. Ask half of these questions. I apologize if I'm kind of asking really basic questions. So tell me about what, you know, you have adopted these two little children. What was, you know, tell me about you and your experience then, because I know that, you know, I know a little bit about you, so I don't want to share that. That's for you to share. So tell me about these two children. Tell me about the impact on your family and your, you know, your ability to parent.
So when we adopted them, they had just turned, they had their birthdays right during the time we were in pre-adoption period. So they had turned 3 and 4. And I also had, my birth son was 3. So we basically had 3 toddlers at the time. So we thought there were definitely some concerning behaviors actually from both of them at the time. You know, like I like to talk about my daughter. She, you know, I found her once in the pantry sitting on the floor eating peanut butter out of the jar. And, you know, my son would eat until he would throw up, which is, you know, very common behavior actually with kids who've been in foster care, these type of food issues and some potty issues. There was an incident where they would scream at night and they would just scream inconsolably. It was really tragic. You know, there was nothing I could do to get them to stop. Even if I was like sitting in their room on the floor while they were going to sleep, they would just scream and scream and scream. We even had our neighbor knocking on the door one day, threatening to call child support, you know, services on us and report us for child abuse because they were screaming. And, you know, all this is happening. And at the time, you know, I had been through the foster parenting system as a foster parent and also through the training. And I knew that these were pretty normal behaviors. I'd seen them in other foster children. And I had been really told, like, once you adopt these kids and they get permanency, it's going to change. That's all they need. They just need this love of a forever family. They need stability. It's going to be okay. And so I kind of was like going with that. And, you know, I also at the time looked through, you get a certain amount of documentation with these kids. And I had gone and I looked through their documentation to find out as much as I could about their history, and found out, you know, they had been neglected. And of course, kids who are neglected, they do things like that with food and, you know, with screaming and things like that. So I really felt like, you know, once, if we can just get to this adoption and then they'll feel secure, they'll feel stable. I have another 3-year-old son who's the same age. I know how to deal with this age kids. So I just felt really confident that we could work with this situation. So, you know, we had, it was a 3-month, there's a mandatory 3-month pre-waiting period, but I think ours ended up being 4 months before we actually were able to see the judge. So we went through the adoption period, and then we adopted, and then we actually moved. We were in Florida at the time. We moved to North Carolina shortly after to live near my sister and brother-in-law and their children. And, you know, over the next few years, my daughter did, her behavior did settle down, and she really bonded with me really well. And I actually think in retrospect, one of the reasons was her hair. She had this masses of beautiful curly hair. And so I had to spend hours doing her hair. You know, you've got to like comb it, you got to wash it, you got to braid it. And so just that like physical contact and the hours with her, I really feel that that's one of the reasons that, you know, we had that closeness and that bonding with her. And she also just in general, she's still has some, I'd say, attachment issues and different things, but she definitely, I felt like I kept seeing a lot of like progress with her. But with my son, his behaviors seem to escalate more. For example, you know, he would go to school and he would punch other kids, or he would kick a hole in his wall in his bedroom. And he would do these things that were really kind of beyond what a kid that age should be doing. Yeah. And again, I had his sister who was a foster, previous foster child. And then I had my birth child. So I had this comparison of them. And he also would act very immature for his age and, you know, use baby talk. And I felt like he was doing that around other people, but not around me. So I felt like he was doing that on purpose to try to get other people, you know, to think that he was younger than he was and to treat him a certain way. And as in, of course, this is in retrospect as it was happening, you know, I was just trying to like do the best I could. And I kept thinking, okay, well, you know, I'm going to just try timeouts. I'm going to try this. I'm going to try that. And nothing was working. And, you know, I just kept thinking, I just try something else. It's going to work. It's going to work. And then finally my real wake up call came when he was, I believe, 9 years old, and he pushed my youngest son, who had I now had another son who was 4, down the stairs and karate chopped him in the neck. And I was like, oh my God, this is dangerous. Someone could really get hurt, because, you know, when they're little and they're like throwing a fit or whatever, you can pick them up and you can like literally pick them up and move them somewhere. But then when they're, as they get bigger, you can't, and you don't think about that unless you're dealing with kids with extreme behaviors. You think, well, just put them in timeout. But it's like a kid has to actually consent to being in timeout. They have to stay in timeout when you put them there. So what do you do if they don't stay in timeout? You know what I mean? And people don't like think about the logistics of that unless you're in that situation. And through those years, I had, you know, he would be throwing like these horrific fits for, you know, hours and hours and hours. And I would tell people and people wouldn't believe me, because they would see him as this very sweet child, because he wouldn't do that in front of other people. And which is very demoralizing for me. And, you know, people think, well, you're an adult, you're a parent, you can handle it. But the truth is, if you're in that situation with someone, you know, say screaming or yelling or whatever for 3 hours every day for months after months after months, people don't have the tolerance to take that if you really think about what that's like. And plus, you've also got work, other kids, your own mental health issues, your own, you know, finances, you have all these other things. So, but I don't think unless you're in that situation or have been in that situation, people really think that through.
I mean, definitely, I think that we see that, you know, I see that amongst many families, that parents, adoptive parents, their world becomes incredibly small, and they don't feel they've got places where they can share information. They stop sharing because of the responses they're getting from people around them. And it's incredibly isolating, incredibly stressful. And there's just no release for it, and frightening at times.
That's right. And I think that, you know, a lot of moms can end up getting PTSD from it, which I did end up getting diagnosed with after the fact, which, you know, to people sounds really extreme, but it's true. I mean, when you really think about the impact of living through that. And one of the things that I talk about a lot is that, especially moms, but parents in general, but moms are being asked to do something that is literally beyond our capacity to do. And people need to start realizing that, you know, it's not within my capacity to take care of a child with that level of behaviors and that level of needs. And so I need support. You know, it's not that I don't want to do it. It's not that I'm trying my best, but my best just isn't good enough. You know, and I think that's the case for most parents. And that goes back to also just the fact that we need to look at this when we're putting kids in homes. you know, because I used to also say, you know, hey, if I didn't have other children in the home, if I, this is my only child, maybe I could do things differently. You know, so they do need to think about that as well and make changes in terms of how they're matching children and families.
So you've got this 9-year-old and you've reached a point, a threshold where the other children, you feel you can't keep them safe, which is kind of a tipping point for lots of parents. We can absorb, we're happy to, or we're not happy, but we will absorb for ourselves. But the minute other children become unsafe, we then have to sort of act or go elsewhere for support. So what did you do? Where did you go? I mean, are there, in the UK, we have ongoing post-adoption support and it's kind of a legal right. The door is open. It's problematic getting through the door sometimes, but you know, you'd move state. So where do you go?
Well, you go through the mental health system.
Right.
And so, and this goes back to having Medicaid. I could have done this with private insurance, but there would have been more limitations, but I did have Medicaid. So I first started by going to the mental health ER, basically went in through the ER, and we went in 4 times and we had one admission through the ER. And what would happen is something would be completely out of control at home and I would take him in and then he would be perfect during the time he was at the ER. And right. So they'd just be like, you know, I don't, you know, this child is lovely. He's so polite. And, you know, this whole like gaslighting, like something's wrong with you. And, you know, and he loved the hospital. So he would literally, one time he wrapped a belt around his neck and said, I'm going to kill myself if you don't take me to the hospital. So then of course you have to take him to the hospital because there's such a risk with that, even if it's just a threat. Right. So I don't remember who, someone very wisely told me, just keep taking him to the mental health ER because eventually Medicaid will not want to pay for that. They will give you better services. So that's what I kept doing, is I just kept taking him there until finally they gave me what's called here intensive in-home services, where they send a group of clinicians into your home for several hours a day. So there were 3 people on the team and they came into our house for 15 hours a week. So they were here in my home for 3 hours a day, every day for 5 days. And the idea is that they are, and it's really in concept, I think it's a really great idea in concept, they're working with the family. So instead of like just going to a therapy session, they come in and they actually are modeling for you. They're like, they would come and do homework with all my kids rather than telling me how to get my kids to do their homework, you know? So it was really helpful, I think.
It sounds like.
But it didn't solve the problem. Yeah, it's a really great concept, actually, but it didn't solve this problem because what would happen is he would just really behave while they were there and then be out of control the rest of the time. And then one day he started throwing a fit in front of one of the workers, one of the clinicians that was there, and she saw it for herself. And she said, this is not a tantrum. You need to stop telling people it's a tantrum. It's not. It's a rage. And she said, that's why you're not getting help, because you're saying it's a tantrum and it's not a tantrum. And then she, at that point, taught me how to do like holds, like kind of a bear hold from the back, because he was destroying my house. He was hurting me. He was hurting other people. And that's when I think when she saw it and there was someone who was, you know, a mental health professional actually saw the incident, that was when I started getting some more action and help, because it wasn't just me saying this is out of control.
I mean, that sounds like an incredible experience, but it must have been also, you must have been in quite a, thinking about it, did you feel incredibly vulnerable at that point? You know, you've got services coming in and sort of up until the point of them seeing, you know, do you think that they were thinking, is this woman the problem? Is it her ability to cope?
Oh, yes. They definitely. And that was a problem, not just in that service, but throughout the whole experience that I had, is that they definitely blame the mother. And the truth is that it's very easy to look at this as a parenting problem and, you know, to come in and say, oh my God, this woman has lost her mind. She's angry. She's freaking out. This is her problem. We've got to fix it. And it is true, actually. I was losing my mind, but that was because what happens is we're getting these services to these families way too late when they're already in crisis and it's too late. We need to get it to them way before that. So what they really should have said is, yeah, this woman is losing her mind and acting crazy, but that's a symptom of something else. How did she get to this point? And what do we need to do to fix that? Not just let's fix her parenting, because that's not going to actually fix the problem, because she was a good parent a year ago, you know, and now she just can't cope anymore.
Foster carer. So you didn't just fall out of the sky. A bit more curiosity about what is going on.
Right. Instead of just this assumption, but I do think it's a very easy assumption, and it's able for them, it's a way for them to deflect away from the fact that they don't have actual solutions, because it's just so easy to focus on, it's the mom, let's just give her some parenting help, you know, and then the mothers feel blamed and they feel shamed, and you feel so much shame because, and this is one of the reasons I talk about this for all of us moms, because it is very shaming, because you adopted these kids, you love them, you want to be a great mom, and it's embarrassing and it's shameful to say, yeah, you know, I'm really struggling like this. I don't like my kid right now. I feel like I'm a bad mom. I feel like I'm a failure. There's a lot of shame tied up in that. And so then when you've got these, your kid is gaslighting you and you've got these therapists telling you you're a bad mom, you know, it's really devastating, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, it parallels, I mean, different systems, but the same narratives are just so current in the UK. And I think one of the latest statistic was about over 65% of adoptive parents experience violence at some point from their children. And it's a taboo. Mm-hmm. People are not talking about it. Certainly not before you arrive at adoption. Can I?
Right.
And sorry.
As you keep with going. Child on parent violence, you're absolutely right. And I think there's even more of a taboo in the United States, because when I've looked into that, I found things in the UK, a lot more information. People are talking about it even more than they are in the United States here. You can't even say that. And people don't believe it. Like, I would say things about, you know, my son is being violent towards me. People dismiss that out of hand. That is just not something that they would consider as being something that could happen. So I agree with you. I mean, it's a huge problem that we're not acknowledging that.
Okay. I'll keep distracting you from the story and opening up bigger questions. Your son's rage has been seen. And so what services, you know, was there a change in the dynamic then where they started to see that he needed he needed something different? And was that available?
Yes. Yeah. So they started kind of changing the way that they were doing the services in my home. And then we had an incident at school where he was supposed to come in from recess, and he walked up the line and punched each of the kids in the stomach, and then punched the teacher, and then attacked the school resource officer. And that was kind of like a tipping point where they realized, you know, we've got to get more help. This agency did that I was working with. So then they put him in what was called partial hospitalization, which is like a day treatment program almost through the mental health hospital. So he would go there during the day and he would have basically school time there and medication management and therapy. It's for kids who can't live at home full time, but they come home at night. So that's where he would go. That went great for a couple of weeks. And then he didn't get there was like a point system. There's point systems in all of these different facilities. There was a point system. He didn't get the points. He freaked out. He ended up getting restrained, you know, on a restraint bed and, you know, getting injections of, they're called PRNs here. I don't know what they're called there, but injections to help him calm down, medications. And so that lasted a few months. And then they said, we can't handle this kid. We need to move him to a PRTF, which is a full-time residential lockdown treatment facility. And so from there, that's where he went into lockdown PRTF facility. And he was 10 at that point. And he was basically bounced out in and out of those facilities, group homes, foster care, PRTF, until he turned 18. So after that point, when he turned 10, he never was able to come home from that time.
I mean, you're just describing that. It sounds horrific for him. In the first instance, you're just, you know, not getting the points. And even, you know, you said points, and I thought, well, we all know that for a lot of children, points and scores just doesn't work. You're setting children up to fail. Yeah. But then, you know, a restraint bed, which is just
horrific.
I mean, for him, it sounds like the dominoes started to fall and they just, you know, the cards fell and he couldn't turn the corner. But for you as a family, that must be horrendous as well.
Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine being strapped to a restraint bed. I mean, to me, I feel like I would just go insane. I mean, that would just be horrible to me. So I think it's terrible. I mean, I understand why they're doing it because these kids can be really dangerous to themselves and to others. So I understand the purpose of it, but I do think that it's absolutely horrendous. And that continued to happen in all of these, you know, PRTF programs that he was in after that. You know, that's what they do when the kids start to get to the point. You know, they put them in seclusion rooms, and then when they start to escalate to being dangerous, that's what they end up doing, is they strap them down and then they give them PRNs, which are shots. Mm. So, and unfortunately, I don't know how it is there, but here, these facilities really are just more or less like holding facilities for these kids, because they're not actually giving them good treatment at all. And they're around a lot of other children. And so they actually get a lot worse in these facilities. And it's not just my son, it's just kind of universally what happens. And so, you know, I was watching him get older and get, you know, his behavior get worse and worse and worse. Mm. But I also knew I couldn't bring him home because of the danger to my other kids. Cause he was, you know, he broke someone's hand. He, you know, stabbed someone with a girl with a pencil. He punched a girl in the back of the head. So I'm sitting and thinking, okay, if he comes home and does that in my house to my children, how can I protect my kids? So I had this terrible choice that parents should never have of, do I leave my son here where he's getting worse and not getting help? Or do I bring him home and put other children at risk? And one of the things that I really regret the most about this is when I looked back, and I didn't realize this for a few years, but during that time he was living at home, I basically was exposing my other kids to domestic violence, and I didn't realize that because I was involved in it. But it's really very similar to, you know, if you had your husband with domestic violence and you had your children in the home witnessing it, it's very similar, but we don't like to talk about that with kids. But it's the same kind of emotions, you know. And my youngest son, he slept in my bed for years after that. He would tremble like a leaf. And it was because he was traumatized from being around that. And I really regret not realizing that. And I don't think we're thinking about the siblings in the home, because it would be considered neglect, at least here in the United States. It's neglect for you to let your children live in that kind of an environment with a domestic violence spouse, you know. And we need to start thinking about what we're exposing the kids to with these siblings who are extremely violent or scary and dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, certainly we would, you know, the UK system would designate that as an abusive situation. You know, to live in a home where there's domestic violence, regardless of who the perpetrator was, if people are threat of violence. I mean, from a UK perspective, we don't have mental health facilities for children. Maybe we count, you know, in the tens as opposed to the hundreds of facilities. It's just not culturally, it's not how we do it. I'm not saying how we do it. I think some cases where we maybe need to do it for some very vulnerable young people. So that is quite, you know, with my UK ears, that sounds like a really quite a difficult system to get out of. Once you're in, that it's sort of self-perpetuating the behavior.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. I can't imagine how, as a parent, sort of, because in the midst of all that, you're a parent in recovery. You're a family in recovery, aren't you? You're not, you know, every day your son moved out isn't the day everything's fine. It's a process, isn't it?
Yeah. I immediately, as soon as he left when he was 10, I went into therapy myself. And I basically went to the therapist. I said, something's wrong with me. What's wrong with me? I need help. You know, I don't love my son. I'm a terrible mother. I need help. I was just devastated. I was broken. I hadn't brushed my hair in 3 months. You know, I was really like in deep depression. And that's when, you know, I went on some anti-anxiety medications. It took me 2 years really to turn that around and to recover. And also a really good therapist that I worked with my son, who allowed me to kind of be able to step that back and see him again as a little child, you know, and want to attach to him, because you do. I know it's a terrible, people don't like it when you say it, but you get to this point where you don't want to attach to them anymore because they're just not nice to you. They're being awful to you. You know what I'm saying? It's really difficult. And so it took this really, we finally found after when he was 12, he had a really great therapist, and she really helped us with that. He wasn't ever to come home and his violent behaviors continued. We started building a relationship at that point when he turned 12. That kind of had a turning point with that therapist.
That's really, there's no easy ways out of any of this, is there? Once you've hit rock bottom, that there's no happily ever after, is there? Which is not the adoption narrative.
That's right. And that's why, and I always say this, we've got to get to families before they're in crisis, because once you're in crisis, it's too late. It's just too late. You know, like if someone had given me the tools, maybe when he was 5 or 6, I'm not sure. I don't think any of this could have been solved, but it could have been different. Our story could have been different if I had had a better approach, better understood what I was dealing with, known who to go to for help, because, you know, I didn't have Medicaid. I didn't know what a group home was. I didn't know what a PRTF was. I had no idea how to even Google to find these things, right? So if I had just been a little bit more prepared, I do think our story could have been better. It couldn't have fixed it, but it could have been better. And he could have had a better outcome than what he had, you know, having basically losing his childhood, which is what happened, which is the biggest tragedy of all, is that he lost his childhood.
Yeah. And I think that story, again, parallels a lot of UK experience, where we look back at when our children are teenagers, we look back and go, if I'd known this stuff then, we maybe wouldn't have got to here. I'm sure we would have got somewhere, but, you know, we would have never lived happily ever after like the Waltons, but we would have maybe been able to keep a lid on things or work through things. And before we started recording, you were chatting about, I'm intrigued to know what's happened to Devin after 18, but we'll talk about that now. So tell me how long ago did he sort of, did he age out of the system, or what happened to 18?
Yeah. So I never lost custody of him or gave up custody of him or to the state, which some people do, but I did not do that. So he eventually, you know, he started getting criminal charges as he got older and things like that, you know, so things got a lot more serious. And then when he turned 18, they basically dropped him off of my doorstep, and with 30 minutes notice, because I had told them that he couldn't come home because I still had young children at home, and they dropped him off. And so I didn't know what to do with him. So I actually put him in a hotel, and I had him in a hotel that I was paying for. I was trying to find something that he could, like some program or something that I put him in. And he basically told me that if I didn't buy him an iPad, he didn't want to stay in the hotel. And then he left, and he was on the street for a little while. And that was actually a real world consequence that he didn't like much. And so he started actually making better choices, because he hadn't had any real world consequences in all these facilities, because they don't give you consequences. He could do whatever he wanted with no consequences. So he started kind of pulling his life together. And he, you know, started trying to integrate in the community, and he started trying to working on his criminal charges, because he does have a couple of felonies, and that's a really big problem in the United States. Once you get a felony, it really destroys your life. He actually moved in with me about a week and a half ago, because his living situation fell apart, and he has 4 months left on this program that he's working on to deal with his felony. And so I'm trying to help him through that, because I really want him to get through that. So he's actually currently living with me right now.
So it sounds like it's not, you know, if you're talking about the 13, 14, 15 year old, it looked pretty catastrophic. So I'm sure it's difficult, but it's not as catastrophic. There's hope.
Yeah. Well, so I think even when he was 13, 14, 15, what I knew was that he could control himself if he would choose to, and he wasn't choosing to. And when he turned 18, he knows, like, you know, if you call the police, they're going to come now. He also, one of the big issues, I don't know if this is in the UK or not, but here is false allegations. So he could make false allegations against staff of abuse, and those staff would get, you know, put out on leave. Well, you can also make false allegations against your parents. And so that was a huge threat towards me. Well, that's gone now that he's 18. So now that he's 18, a lot of that dysfunction of the system is out of our relationship. He doesn't have that leverage over me. And so that's really changes the dynamic of our relationship. And I'm able to say, okay, I'm going to help you. And he knows, if I want my mom's help, you know, I need to behave myself, because she doesn't have to help me in the way she did before, because I don't have this leverage. She's just, you know, helping me out of the goodness of her heart, and I need to behave myself. Do you see what I mean? I mean, the dynamic changes.
Very different dynamic, very different. So that's, that mm-hmm. gives some hope for optimism for the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think somebody could look at that and say, how can we somehow figure out how to reflect that in the system when they're younger? Because it is true that they can control themselves if they're properly incentivized. And I don't know the answer. I don't pretend to know the answer. I can only explain what the problem is, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a very complicated dynamic. And I think in the midst of it, when, you know, like when he was 10 and as a family, you need someone to come in and make sense of it, because everyone's headspace is totally somewhere, you know, it's in the wrong, we're all in the wrong place. I think at that moment of crisis, you need people with real clarity to come and help us step out of that. And you talked at the beginning about, before we started recording, you talked about how it's a purposefully closed system, the foster to adopt system in the US. So tell me about your views on that and kind of how you've perhaps not done that.
So in the United States, when you adopt a child out of foster care, they are purposely, they hide that child from the birth parents, which I believe the concept is, you know, you're supposedly this child has been abused, and a lot of times they have. And so you don't want that birth parent to come in and find them for the sake of the child. And also the adoptive parents would be scared if they knew that the birth parent could show up at any time. So you get a brand new social security card that is not linked to the child, to the old one. You also get a new birth certificate with your name. So my adopted children have birth certificates just like my birth children that have my name, my husband's name. It looks just the same. And the link is completely severed. So the two birth certificates are not connected in any way. The two social securities are not connected in any way. So literally there's no contact. It's complete cut off from the birth, not only the birth mother and father, if there's a birth father in the picture, but also any birth family. So if there was like a grandmother or an aunt or anyone in the picture, that's it. It's completely, you know, cut off, right? So when I started, as I said, during the pre-adoption period, when I started noticing these odd behaviors, one of the things I did is go back and look through the documentation, and it had information about their birth mom. And just so you know, I have permission from her to speak about this, but it had information about her and her own experience. She was a foster child herself when she had my son. Explained how she had basically aged out of the system. She didn't have any services, and he was found in a hotel, but only after 30 minutes. And he didn't even have a soiled diaper. And I thought, that's so strange, because, you know, I would never leave my kid in the hotel for 30 minutes, but people do it all the time, like go do their laundry or whatever. They don't lose their kid forever for that. Right. That just doesn't, it just never sat right with me. And I was like, something is odd about this story. And I also thought, you know, she herself was a foster kid who was, you know, had just aged out. So she was 18 and she had no support. So I kind of like tucked all that information away, and I had in there like her birth date and some information about her. And I just kind of put it away in my attic and kept it. And then whenever my kids would ask about their birth mom, which I was always very open about the fact that they were adopted, I would say things like, well, she was very young, she loved you. And I would say those types of things because I felt like that was true from what I had read. And I felt like that was what was good for them. And I at one point went and I found she had, I found a mugshot actually of her from when she had been arrested for writing a bad check. And I printed it out. She was beautiful. She's beautiful. She was beautiful in her mugshot. So I printed it out, framed it for the kids, and they loved it. But so I did that. So then at one point around, I guess maybe when the kids, maybe when my daughter was like maybe 9 and my son was 10, around that age period, I found where she was in prison, again, serving time for nonviolent offenses. And so I sent her some pictures of the kids. Because I just had this connection. I just felt like something about this, you know, didn't feel right. So I sent her some pictures and a Christmas card. And then the next year did it again. The second time I sent her like with a return address, and she sent me back this letter. And I expected this really like kind of vindictive letter back towards me, because when I was a foster parent and I had dealt with birth parents, they were always very angry at foster parents, but it wasn't. She was just like, thank you so much for taking care of my kids. I'm so grateful. Thank you for these pictures. I just thought I'd never see them again. And so I just felt like good about her. So over time, I continued to be in contact with her and keep track of her. And then eventually, I let my daughter start messaging with her on Facebook. And then she started having phone calls with her and doing like FaceTime with her. And my son had a little bit of contact with her, but the therapist didn't think that that was a very good idea because he was in these facilities at the time, but he did have a little bit. And then at one point, she actually came to our house and stayed with us for a weekend. And it was really wonderful because she told them their birth stories. She apologized to them and said, "I loved you so much. I'm sorry I couldn't take care of you." She told them that she was so happy that they had a great adoptive family. And we're still in touch with her. And I don't think that every story has a happy ending like that. But I do think that there can be a lot more happy endings like that than what we're allowing for, because at least in the United States, a lot of birth mothers are losing their children because of poverty neglect, not because of what I would consider like a willful neglect. And that's what happened with her. In fact, what she told me is she said, when my daughter was taken from her, I told you she was taken in the hospital, right from her hospital bed that day because of her son was in foster care. She said they gave her, you know, she knew she had to do this whole list of things, right? She had to take parenting classes. She had to pay child support. She had to get a place to live. She had to do all these things. And she said, I'm just going to be honest with you. She said, I gave up. I just knew there was no way I could do it. There was just no way I could get my kids back. And it's true. Like, if you think about it, someone like that, they don't have a ride to the parenting classes. Something as simple as that, you know, which to me, I would take for granted, but she didn't because she didn't have any family. And so I think sometimes we vilify these birth parents when we don't have to. And sometimes an open adoption can be a good thing, not just for the birth parents, but definitely for the kids, because my kids, I think, feel much better having that relationship and knowing who she is and a little bit about her. And like I said, having that wonderful experience of her telling them their birth stories and saying, "I'm sorry, and I love you, and I wish I could take care of you." I really think that was very healing for them.
So, I mean, that's a remarkable story, given that the kind of the general flow is away from contact, isn't it? And even though we, you know, a lot of people pay lip service to it, they often it's the door shuts and the you know, for a whole host of reasons, people get caught up in their lives and worried and, you know, lack of support. So I know now that you've written some books, you've got a huge Facebook page with lots of people follow, and you're campaigning for lots of issues. Where do you sit now, and what are you doing with all your campaigning? Tell me your messages, your banners, your flying.
Well, what I'm really trying to speak up for is the fact that we don't have services and treatments that work. A lot of people talk about access. So they talk about, we need to get access for families. I mean, I'm sure there are access issues, but even when you have access, because I had access, the services are not there. The treatments are not there. Yeah. So I'm talking a lot about that. And I'm also talking a lot about the impact of families, because I think that we focus a lot on how this affects the child, which of course is very important, but we forget about how it's affecting the siblings and the mother. And I think that that's equally important. People are really minimizing that. And I think, especially for the siblings, I think it can be extremely traumatic. And so I'm trying to talk about that. And also I'm trying to speak up on behalf of those people who, like I said, have felt blamed and shamed and like they can't speak. So I'm trying to speak for all of us and say, let me say my story, because this is more than my story. It's everyone's story. And I'll speak up and I'll tell the truth and I'll be transparent for everyone so we can get that story out there.
Yeah. So you've written a couple of books. You've written specifically in relation to reactive attachment disorder, which I think is people in the UK will be familiar with that diagnosis, but it's a very, very rare diagnosis in the UK. But in the US, we've got a different culture around diagnosis to you. So I think that's probably why it's more prevalent. So that's that's one of the key sort of cornerstones of what you're doing. So tell me a little bit about reactive attachment disorder and kind of how people perceive it in the US and kind of what is there for them.
Okay. So, you know, reactive attachment disorder is where a child is unable to bond with a caregiver based on early childhood trauma, essentially. And it is a rare diagnosis in the general population, but it is much more prevalent among adoptive children. And there is a lot of controversy about it as a diagnosis. A lot of people, you know, are looking towards moving towards like developmental trauma disorder. And I actually agree with that. However, right now, that is not an official diagnosis, developmental trauma disorder. It's not something you can get covered by insurance. So even though philosophically, I totally agree with that. I right now talk about reactive attachment disorder because that is a legitimate diagnosis that's being given to our children and that we can get health insurance coverage for. And what I like to, the way I like to describe it to people is I like to describe it as like a tug of war. I had my birth child and he would just whimper. I would be there, right? Immediately. So he has this innate security. My mom is always going to be there for me because even when I was an infant, before I could even really form thoughts around it, I know that I whimpered and my mom was there, right there every time. But with a child who maybe has been in foster care, they might, you know, be in their crib crying and the caregiver, maybe they don't come sometimes, or maybe they come and their tone of voice is angry, or maybe they hit them, or maybe sometimes they do come feed them. And so they have this innate insecurity in them. And so what they do is they then come into this adoptive family and they form this kind of tug of war with their mother, especially with their mother, because if they can kind of exert control over her and power over her, it gives them this subconscious feeling of, I'm safe, I'm secure, I can control this, because they couldn't control, you know, their lives earlier. And again, it's like a subconscious thing. But it comes down to control. And I think that's part of the problem for parents like myself. I didn't realize that in the time. So I, of course, picked up the other line of the tug of war rope and I was pulling right back because I didn't understand that's what was going on, right? But if I had known, I might have done things differently because I would have realized what was happening behind that. But instead, I was just thinking, oh, well, this kid is not respecting me as a parent. Let me just tug that rope and say, no, you do it my way, right? And you don't do that if you understand. So that's kind of how I like to picture reactive attachment disorder. So one of the things I did a few years ago is I wrote this little guidebook, which actually quite a few people in the UK have read and purchased, because I realized that families needed like a real quick kind of primer on this is what it is. This is what I need to do. This is what I need to know, because that information was out there, but in bits and pieces, different places, or maybe it was a very controversial book. So a lot, you know, big chunks of it were very controversial. So I wanted something that would be able to give people information quickly that they needed. And so that was kind of my goal. I give tons of the book away. I give it away whenever Amazon will let me give it away for free. just as a way to kind of, to help parents, you know, just give them that start that I didn't have. Like, here's all the stuff I wish I had known. Like that, like the tug of war.
I think that's a fantastic way of describing it, because I think that so often we can wrap it in high language and, you know, big thoughts, but actually that's what it feels like. This child is, you know, this tug of war. I think it's a wonderful description. Have you seen progress? Are you seeing things change? Are you seeing things, you know, have you got specific... Are you looking for specific changes, or just a sort of a trying to change the culture and how people think about this stuff?
Well, so like I said, I don't feel like I have the answers. You know, when I would sit in these therapy sessions, I didn't feel like I knew the answer. I just knew that I wasn't getting the right answer and that the people around me didn't have the right answer. Quite frankly, I was really shocked. The fact that there were no answers for this. I was really shocked that there were no treatments. I was shocked by the behavior. It was just extremely surprising to me. It was like this whole new world that I would never have known about had I not had this experience. And so that's why once I had gotten kind of on the other end of it, I started working on writing a book, make people aware. So I started kind of writing a very traditional nonfiction book about my experience and about the dysfunctions in the system, and, you know, how the mental, like, for example, how PRTF, why doesn't it work for these kids, how it's so incredibly broken, that sort of thing. And as I was writing it, I started thinking about the fact that that book might be good, but it wasn't going to change anyone's mind. It wasn't going to, you know, result in any paradigm shift that was necessary. And the only thing that could really change someone's mind or open this up is if they could experience it and live it for themselves. And because that's, of course, what happened to me. And so that's why I ended up this book that I just wrote. I wrote it as a reads like fiction narrative, even though it's memoir and it's true, because my kind of vision for it was that, you know, you could give it to your family member and say, read this, and they could actually walk through it and they could experience it and understand the nuances themselves. And so the book I wrote really doesn't, it doesn't really give any answers, doesn't really give any solutions. It's more about saying, let me show you the problem, you know, therapist, let me show you the problem so that the real problem, the underlying problem, so you can come up with solutions for us. And family and friends, let me show you the real problem so you can support our families better. And so that was kind of the idea or the vision that I had behind the current book that I just put out.
And what's the book called?
It's called But He Spit in My Coffee.
Which is quite a provocative title, but I know exactly what you mean. And also you've got a Facebook page. What is the Facebook page called?
I do. It's called Raising Devin. And I mostly post on there some, I have a blog post and some articles that I post and different, you know, encouraging links. And also we have several online private support groups for families, particularly for moms who are dealing with, you know, children with extreme behaviors or with reactive attachment disorder or any of these types of behaviors. And so that's, I connect people to those groups as well.
That's fantastic. Well, Devin, Kerry, I've taken up almost an hour of your time. So I thank you so much for being so open and candid in relation to your experience. And I know that you've anonymized everything there that we've talked about. So if people are thinking, oh, she's, you know, they've changed the names. So thank you so much for your time and really appreciate you sort of shedding a light on your life and a bit of the US system.
Yes, thank you so much.